I lock the car and take his arm. He relaxes a little, and we walk towards the headland. Focus on the good times, I think. Remember that time you and Dad dressed as the Crankies for the summer party? Billy laughs. We argued over who got to be Wee Jimmy, and I won because I was the short ass. Only then the two of you got pissed and fought about it all over again. We burst out laughing at the memory of Wee Jimmy and Dad rolling around the showroom floor. Dad and Uncle Billy fought in the way only brothers fight, fast and furious, and over as soon as it began. We fall into a companionable silence as we walk, interspersed with occasional snorts of laughter, as Billy recalls the night of the Crankies all over again. He squeezes my arm. Thank you for making me come. It was about time I faced up to it. We're standing on the clifftop now, safely back from the edge. Neither of us have proper coats on, and the rain is coming from all directions, soaking through my running jacket. Out at sea, a small boat with red sails cuts through the grey, choppy water. I think of Mum, standing where we are now. Was she scared? Or was she here with someone she trusted? Someone she thought was a friend? A lover, even, although the thought sickens me. Is it possible my mother had been having an affair? Do you think she knew? Billy doesn't say anything. When she came up here, do you think she knew she was going to die? Anna, don't. Billy starts walking back towards the car park. I run to catch up. Don't you want to know what really happened? No. Give me the keys. I'll drive back. The rain has pasted Billy's hair to his head. He holds out his hands, but I stand still, defiant, the keys between us. Don't you see? If Mum and Dad were killed, it changes everything. It means they didn't leave us. They didn't give up on life. The police will look for their murderer. They'll find answers for us. Billy! We stare at each other, and then, to my horror, I see Billy is crying. His mouth works without words, like the TV on mute, and then he turns up the sound, and I wish with all my being I'd driven towards Hastings instead. I don't want answers, Annie. I don't want to think about how they died. I want to think about the way they lived. I want to remember the good times and the funny times and the nights in the pub. His voice gets gradually louder, until he's shouting at me, the wind whipping the words straight at me. The tears have stopped, but I've never seen Billy like this before. I've never seen him out of control. His fists are tightly balled, and he shifts from one foot to another, like he's spoiling for a fight. Mum was murdered. Surely you want to know who did it. It won't change anything. It won't bring her back. But we'll have justice. Someone will pay for what they did. Billy turns and walks away. I run after him, pulling him back by the shoulder. I just want answers, Uncle Billy. I loved her so much. He stops walking, but he won't look at me, and in his face is a mixture of grief and anger, and something else, something confusing. Understanding comes a split second before he speaks, so quietly the wind almost takes it away without me hearing it. Almost, but not quite. So did I. We sit in the car park, watching the rain on the windscreen. Every now and then a strong gust of wind rocks the car, and I'm glad we came down from the cliffs when we did. I remember the first time I saw her, Billy says, and it should feel awkward, but it doesn't because he's not really here. He's not sitting in a Porsche Boxster at Beachy Head with his niece. He's somewhere else entirely, remembering. Tom and I were living in London. Tom had done some big deal at work and we'd gone to Amnesia to celebrate. VIP passes, the lot. It was a big night. Tom drank champagne all night, spent the whole time on the sofa with a string of girls. I think he thought he was Peter Stringfellow. Billy gives me a sidelong glance. He flushes, and I worry he's going to clam up, but he keeps talking. It was 1989. Your mum was there with a friend. They didn't give a second glance to the VIP area. They were on the dance floor all night. She was stunning, your mum. Every now and then, some guy would come up to them and make a move, but they weren't interested. Girls' night out, Caroline said later. You spoke to her? Not then, but I gave her my number. I'd been plucking up the courage all night. Then suddenly, it was last orders and everyone was leaving, and I thought I'd missed my chance. I've almost forgotten that he's talking about my mother. I'm captivated by the expression on Billy's face. I've never seen him like this before. Then there she was, in the queue for the cloakroom. And I thought, if I don't do it now... So, I did. I asked if she would take my number, give me a call. Only I didn't have a pen, and she laughed, and said, was I the sort of bloke who would forget his wallet, too? And her friend found an eyeliner pencil, and I wrote my number on Caroline's arm. I can see it so clearly. Mum in her 80s finery, big hair and neon leggings. Uncle Billy gauche and sweating with nerves. Mum would have been 21, which would have made Billy 28, Dad 3 years older. Did she call you? Billy nodded. We went out for a drink, had dinner a few days later. I took her to see Simply Red at the Albert Hall, then... He stopped. What happened? I introduced her to Tom. We sit in silence for a while, and I think about poor Uncle Billy, and wonder how I feel about my parents breaking his heart. I saw it straight away. She'd had a laugh with me, but... I went to get the drinks, and when I came back, I stood in the doorway and watched them. Oh, Billy, they didn't... No, nothing like that, not for ages. Not till they'd both talked to me, and apologized, and said they never meant to hurt me. But they had this connection. I already knew I'd lost her. But then you all worked together. How could you bear it? Billy gives a rueful laugh. What was I supposed to do? Lose Tom, too? By the time your granddad got ill and Tom and I took over the business, you were on your way, and it was water under the bridge. He shakes himself and turns to me with his trademark jollity, except that I know it's an act, and I wonder how many other times I've been fooled. I wonder if Mum and Dad were fooled. I love you, Uncle Billy. I love you too, sweetheart. Now, let's get you back to that baby of yours, shall we? We drive back sedately, Billy cornering the Boxster like he's in a Toyota Yaris. He drops me off outside Oak View. One more sleep, he says, the way he used to when I was a kid. I'll see you first thing in the morning. We'll have a great Christmas. I mean it. Billy didn't let his past dictate his future, and I can't either. Mum and Dad are gone, and whatever the circumstances of their deaths, nothing's going to change that. Joan isn't due back with Ella for another hour. Ignoring the damp seeping through my running clothes, I put on an apron and make 2 batches of mince pies. I fill the slow cooker with red wine, orange slices and spices, pour in a generous slug of brandy, and then turn the heat on low. The doorbell rings, and I rinse my hands and look for a towel. It rings again. All right, I'm coming. Rita barks just once, and I put my hand on her collar, half to chastise, half in reassurance. She lets out a series of miniature growls like a revving engine, but doesn't bark again. Her wagging tail tells me there's nothing amiss. Our front door is painted white, with a stained glass panel across the top half that catches the afternoon sun and throws colours onto the tiled floor. When visitors arrive, their silhouettes stretch out across the floor, interrupting the rainbow. As a child, I would tiptoe around the edges of the hall when I answered the door. Stepping through someone's shadow felt like walking on a grave. The winter sun is low, and the visitor's outline stretches thin, like the reflection in a carnival mirror, their head almost touching the base of the banister. A child again, I skirt the wall towards the door. Rita has no such qualms. She bounds across the shadow, her claws skittering, and comes to a skidding halt by the front door. I turn the key, open the door. And then the world falls silent, and all I can hear is the blood pounding in my head. I see a car pass in the street, but it makes no noise because the drumming in my ears beats faster and faster, and I put out a hand to steady myself, but it isn't enough, and my knees are buckling beneath me, and it can't be. It can't be. But there, on the step, somehow different and yet the same, there on the step, undeniably alive, is my mother.
Part 2. Chapter 27. Anna. I have lost the power of speech. I have lost the power of thought. A thousand questions race around my head, and I wonder if perhaps I've gone mad. If I'm imagining that my mother, my dead mother, is standing on my top step. Her hair, long and kept ash blonde for as long as I can remember it, has been dyed black, the length cropped harshly to above her chin. She wears unflattering wire-framed glasses and a shapeless, baggy dress, unlike anything I've ever seen her in. "Mum?" I whisper it, afraid that speaking out loud will break whatever spell has been cast, and that my mother, this odd new version of my mother, will vanish as quickly as she appeared. She opens her mouth, but it seems I'm not the only one lost for words. I see the tears build above her lower lashes, and as they fall, I feel wetness on my own cheeks. "Mum?" Louder this time, but still hesitant. I don't know what's happening, but I don't want to question it. My mother has come back to me. I've been given a second chance. Pressure builds in my chest, and it seems impossible my ribs can contain the thumping coming from my heart. I let go of Rita because I can't breathe, and I need my arms free. I need to put my hands on my face, to feel that I'm real, because this can't be happening. It can't be happening. Rita springs forward and jumps at Mum, licking her hands and weaving between her legs, whining and wagging her tail furiously. My mother, whose frozen stance has until now mirrored mine, bends to fuss her, and the familiar movement releases an involuntary gasp from within me, as though I'm emerging from water. "You're..." I drag each word out into the world as if using them for the first time. "Actually here." She straightens, takes a breath. Her tears have stopped, but there's such anxiety in her eyes, it's as though she's the one mourning me. Life is moving like sand beneath my feet, and I don't know what's real and what's not anymore. I'm seized by paranoia. Has the last year been a nightmare? Could it have been me who died? It feels that way. My head spins with a lightheadedness that makes me sway, and my mother steps forward, one hand outstretched in concern. I step back, confusion making me frightened, and she takes her hand away, hurt in her eyes. I've started to cry noisily, and she glances over her shoulder towards the road. Every movement she makes is achingly familiar. Every movement makes this harder to understand, because it means this isn't my imagination. I haven't conjured a vision of my mother. I haven't gone mad. She isn't a ghost. She's actually here, living, breathing. What's happening? I don't understand. "Can I come in?" My mother's voice, low and calm, is the voice of my childhood, of bedtime stories and post-night terror reassurance. She calls the dog, who has tired of running circles around her, and is sniffing the gravel at the bottom of the steps. Rita obeys instantly, trotting inside. My mother takes another cautious glance around, hesitates on the threshold, waiting to be asked. I have imagined this moment every day for the last year. I have dreamed about it, fantasized about it. Coming home, and finding my parents going about their business as though nothing had happened, as though the whole thing had been a terrible dream. I've imagined getting a call from the police to tell me my father was swept out to sea, that he was rescued by a fishing boat, lost his memory, that my mother survived her fall, that they were coming back to me. In my dreams, I throw myself at my parents. We cling to each other fiercely, hugging, touching, making sure, and then we talk, words tumbling over each other, interrupting, crying, apologizing, promising. In my dreams, there is noise and happiness and sheer joy. My mother and I stand silently in the doorway. The grandfather clock whirs in the prelude to the hour. Rita, who has never liked the sound, disappears to the kitchen, having presumably satisfied herself that her mistress is here, is real. The chimes ring out. When my father brought home this clock, bought it at auction the year I started secondary school, the three of us looked at each other as it rang the hour. "We'll never sleep through that," my mother said, half laughing, half appalled. Even the ticking was intrusive, echoing each passing second in the empty hall. But sleep we did, and before too long, I only noticed the clock when the mechanism had stopped, and the absence of tick-tock, tick-tock made the house feel empty. Now we look at each other, my mother and I, as each hour echoes into the space between us. Only when it has stopped, and the final peal has faded, does she speak. "I know this is a shock." Was there ever more of an understatement? "We've got a lot to talk about." I find my voice. "You didn't die." There are so many questions, but this one, the fundamental truth, is the one with which I am struggling the most. She didn't die. She isn't a ghost. She shakes her head. "We didn't die." "We?" I hold my breath. "Dad?" A beat. "Darling, there's a lot you have to know." Slowly, I make my brain compute what I'm hearing. My father is alive. My parents didn't die at Beachy Head. So, it was an accident. I knew it. Was certain of it. My parents would never try to kill themselves. But an accident, not murder. An accident. Two accidents. A ticker tape runs through my head as I apply this new narrative to the scenes I never have understood. Two accidents. Eyewitnesses mistaken. Falls, not jumps. Identical falls. The tape stops. A sigh from my mother, resigned, tired. She fidgets, pushing one black strand of hair behind her ears, in a gesture futile now that it is so short. She nods towards the kitchen. "Can I come in?" But the ticker tape has jammed. It twists into knots in my head because what I'm imagining doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. "Dad sent you a text." The longest of pauses. "Yes." She holds my gaze. "Please, can we sit down inside? It's complicated." But suddenly, it seems simple, and the shifting sands beneath my feet grow still, and the tilted world starts to spin again. There's only one explanation. "You faked your deaths." I observe my calmness, as though standing in the wings, congratulate myself on my presence of mind. Yet, even as I say it, even as I know without any shred of doubt that I'm right, I pray that I'm wrong. Because it's preposterous. Because it's illegal, immoral. But more than that, because it's cruel. Because their leaving me broke my heart, and has continued to chip away at it every day since. And to know that my parents did that deliberately will shatter it completely. My mother's face screws up like paper. Tears splash onto the stone step. A single word. "Yes." The hand I move could belong to someone else. I touch the edge of the door, lightly, with two fingers, and I slam it hard in her face.
Chapter 28. Murray. The second floor of the police station was deserted. Most of the back office staff didn't work weekends, and those who did were already on leave. Only the superintendent's office was occupied, with the boss himself on a call, and his PA typing a report without a single glance at her fingers. She had tinsel in her hair, and was wearing bauble earrings that flashed distractingly. "The super needs case papers typing up," she had explained, when Murray had wondered what she was doing at work on a Sunday morning and Christmas Eve to boot. "He wants everything shipshape before the break." "Doing something nice tomorrow?" she said now.
"Just a quiet one at home." There was a pause. "You?" he added, when it became clear she was waiting for the question.
"Off to Mum and Dad's."
She stopped typing and leaned her folded arms on the desk.
"We all still have stockings, even though my brother's 24. We open those first, then we have smoked salmon and scrambled eggs with Buck Fizz."
Murray smiled and nodded as she took him through the traditions of her family Christmas. He wondered how long his bollocking was going to last. The office door opened.
"Murray, sorry to keep you waiting."
"No problem." Murray omitted the "sir," not only because he was a civilian now, and no longer bound by rank, but because when Leo Griffiths had been a probationer, and Murray his tutor constable, the younger man had been a grade A turd. There were two easy chairs in Leo's office, but the superintendent sat at his desk, and so Murray took the wooden chair across from him. An expanse of polished wood lay between them, on which Leo pushed around the paperclips that justified his salary. Leo laced his fingers together and leaned back in his chair.
"I'm a little confused."
He wasn't, of course, but the superintendent liked to show his workings out, which tended to draw out the process somewhat.
"Night turn attended an incident just before midnight last night, where they spoke to a Mr. Mark Hemmings and his partner, Miss Anna Johnson."
Ah, so it was indeed about the Johnson case.
"A brick was thrown through a bedroom window. It had a threatening note wrapped around it."
"So I heard. A few of the houses in that street have their own security cameras. It would be worth
all in hand, thank you,"
Leo interrupted smoothly.
"I'm more concerned about the fact that Miss Johnson reported the incident as part of an ongoing series."
He paused for dramatic effect.
"An ongoing series being investigated by you."
Murray said nothing. You could tie yourself up in knots, saying something for the sake of it, filling gaps. "Ask a question, Leo, then I'll answer it." The pause went on forever.
"And what I'm confused about, Murray, is that I was under the impression you were a station duty officer, a civilian station duty officer, and that you retired from CID, and indeed from the police service, several years ago."
No comment. A hint of annoyance had crept into Leo's voice. He was having to work far harder than he was used to.
"Murray, are you investigating a crime series involving two historic suicides?"
"I'm not, no." They were murders, not suicides.
"Then what exactly have you been doing?"
Anna Johnson came into the front counter on Thursday to discuss some concerns she had over her parents' sudden deaths, both of which occurred last year. I spent some time answering her questions. Murray gave Leo a benign smile. "One of the objectives in my PDR is to deliver a high level of customer service, sir." Leo narrowed his eyes. "Night turn said she'd received a malicious communication. An anonymous card, delivered on the anniversary of her mother's death. There's nothing on the system. Why didn't you generate a crime report?" "What offense would that have been?" Murray asked politely. "There was no threat in the card, no abuse. It was upsetting, of course, but
It wasn't illegal. There was a long pause while Leo digested this information. A brick through a window is a criminal act, interrupted Murray smoothly, and I'm sure the attending officers will do an excellent job investigating it. Miss Johnson seems to think her mother's suicide was, in fact, murder. So I understand. Murray gave a polite smile. Of course, it was the CID team here who looked at the case last year. Leo looked at Murray, assessing whether the insinuation had been intentional. If he told Murray off for not taking the job to CID, there was an implicit criticism that the original investigation had been mishandled. Murray waited.
Write up your involvement so far and pass everything up to CID for them to take a proper look at. Understood?
Perfectly. Murray stood, not waiting to be dismissed. Merry Christmas.
Indeed. And Murray?
Yes?
Stick to your own job.
Murray hadn't lied to the superintendent yet, and he wasn't going to start now. Don't worry, Leo. He gave the boss a cheery smile. I won't do anything I'm not qualified to do. Downstairs, Murray found an empty report writing room and closed the door before logging on to the computer. He had given back his force laptop when he retired, and there were a few more checks he wanted to do before he went home for Christmas. If Leo Griffiths had the nous to look at Murray's intranet activity, it could be easily explained away as essential information required for the write-up he would have to put together for CID. He looked up Oakview on the command and control system that logged every call made to police. This basic check would have been done by the original investigating officers, but there were no printouts in the archived file, and Murray wanted to be thorough. He was looking for break-ins, harassment, suspicious activity connected to Oakview or the Johnsons. Anything that might suggest Tom and Caroline had been targeted prior to their deaths. Oakview appeared several times over the years since computerized records had been kept. Twice, a silent 999 call had been made from the address. Each time, control room had called back and been given the same explanation. Occupant apologizes, toddler was playing with phone. Murray checked the date on the log. 10th of February 2001. Toddler? Anna Johnson would have been 10. Too old to be making accidental phone calls. Had there been a toddler in the house? Or were the silent 999 calls a deliberate cry for help? In 2008, control room had received a call from a neighbor, Robert Drake, who reported hearing a disturbance next door. Murray looked through the log. Caller states he can hear shouting, sound of broken glass, possible domestic, units dispatched. No crime had been recorded. All quiet on arrival, details taken, both occupants deny any domestic incident. Caroline Johnson had appeared emotional, Murray noted, but there was scant detail in the brief log, and without tracking down the attending officers and hoping they could recall an incident that occurred more than a decade ago, that was all he had to go on. It was enough. Murray was starting to build up a picture of the Johnsons, and it wasn't the one their daughter had portrayed. Perhaps Tom's brother, Billy Johnson, would throw more light on proceedings. Murray looked at his watch. Bloody Leo Griffiths and his posturing. He'd be late to collect Sarah if he didn't go now. She'd be emotionally fraught enough as it was today. Even the tiniest change of plans could knock her off kilter.
I'll come with you.
Murray had made it just in time, only for Sarah to immediately ask after the Johnson case, and insist on accompanying him to see Billy. It'll keep till after Christmas. Murray put the car in gear and drove slowly out of Highfield. It felt good to have Sarah in the car, to know he wasn't going home to an empty house.
It's fine, honestly. It's practically on our way home, anyway.
Murray stole a glance at his wife. Even in the car she didn't sit properly. One foot was tucked beneath the knee of her other leg. She held the seatbelt away from her neck with one hand, her elbow resting on the bottom of the window.
If you're sure,
I'm sure. Johnson's cars had been given a facelift since Murray had bought his Volvo. There was still the same motley collection of part exchange bangers parked around the back, but most of the forecourt was filled with gleaming Jags, Audis, and BMWs, the most expensive angled on ramps that made the cars look like they were about to make a break for it. 10 minutes, he said. No rush. Sarah took off her seatbelt and opened her book. Murray pocketed the keys, automatically scanning the inside of the car for anything that might present a risk. She's been discharged, he reminded himself as he walked away. Relax. He looked back as he crossed the forecourt, but Sarah was engrossed in her book. Clean-shaven sales reps circled like sharks, two homing in on him from opposite directions, both with an eye on their commission. A gangly lad, with a shock of ginger hair, reached him first, his colleague peeling off towards a sharply dressed couple, wandering hand in hand along a line of convertibles. A far safer bet, Murray thought. Billy Johnson? In the office. The ginger lad jerked his head towards the showroom. But perhaps I can assist. His smile was all tooth and no sincerity. He cocked his head to one side, making a show of appraising Murray, considering. Volvo, man. Am I right? Considering Murray had just got out of precisely such a car, this insight was less impressive than it might have been. He kept walking. Through here, is it? Ginger shrugged, his shiny smile vanishing with his chances of a sale. Yeah, Shanine on the desk will get him for you. Shanine had a face 2 degrees darker than her neck, and lips so glossy Murray could see his reflection in them. She was standing behind a large, curved reception desk, tinsel taped to the side, setting out glasses on a tray for a Christmas Eve tipple. She smiled as he approached. Welcome to Johnson's Cars, how may I help you? She rattled off, so fast Murray had to pause for a second to process what he'd heard. I'd like to see Billy Johnson, please. I'm from Sussex Police. I'll see if he's free. She teetered on pointed toe heels that couldn't possibly be the same shape as her feet, click clacking across the polished floor to her boss's office. Tinted glass meant Murray couldn't see inside it, and he looked out of the vast showroom windows instead, wishing he'd been able to park the Volvo a little closer. The angle meant he couldn't see Sarah. He glanced at his watch. He'd already taken 3 of the 10 minutes he'd promised he'd be. Come through, Mr. Shanine appeared in the doorway, tailing off as she realized she'd forgotten to ask Murray's name. Mackenzie. Murray Mackenzie. He smiled at the receptionist as she passed him, and walked into an impressive office housing 2 large desks. Billy Johnson stood up. His forehead glistened, and when he shook Murray's hand, it was warm and clammy. He didn't smile, and he didn't offer Murray a seat. CID, eh? Murray didn't set him straight. To what do we owe the pleasure? Our last break-in was 6 months ago, so that's a piss-poor response time, even by your standards. The smile implied a joke the words lacked. Billy Johnson was generous of stomach, portly rather than fat, and not unattractive with it, Murray supposed, although what did he know? He wore a well-cut suit, highly polished shoes, and a bright yellow tie that matched the stripes on his wide-collared shirt. The defensiveness was undoubtedly due to stress, not aggression, but nevertheless, Murray stayed within striking distance of the door. If it's about the VAT... It isn't. Billy relaxed a little. I'm making inquiries about the deaths of your brother and his wife. You the officer our Annie's been dealing with? You're her uncle, I believe. Even through Billy's distress, his affection for Anna was evident. His eyes softened, and he nodded repeatedly, as though the action reinforced the fact. Such a lovely girl. This has all been very hard for her. For all of you, proffered Murray. Yes, yes, of course, but for Annie. He pulled a large white handkerchief from his pocket and wiped at his brow. I'm sorry, it's been a rather emotional morning. Please, sit down. He sank down into a leather swivel chair She's convinced herself Tom and Caroline were murdered. Murray paused. I think she's right. Christ. Through the window behind Billy, Murray caught sight of a familiar figure meandering through the rows of cars. Sarah. 20 yards behind her, walking as swiftly as it was possible to walk without running, was Ginger.
Were you close to Tom, Mr. Johnson?
Murray spoke quickly, half an eye on the forecourt. Billy frowned.
We were brothers. You got on well?
He seemed irritated by the question.
We were brothers. We had each other's backs, but we got each other's backs up, too. You know what I mean?
Business partners, too, I understand. Billy nodded.
Dad had dementia and couldn't run the business anymore, so Tom and I took over in 1991.
Family, he added, as though that explained everything. There was an open checkbook in front of him, next to a pile of envelopes and a printed list. He shuffled the envelopes together needlessly, nodded to the checkbook.
Christmas bonuses. Smaller than normal, but that's life.
How did you get on with Caroline? A crimson flush crept over the man's neck.
She ran the desk. Tom looked after that side of things. I managed the sales team.
Murray noted that Billy hadn't answered his question. He didn't push it. He wasn't supposed to be there at all. The last thing Murray needed was another complaint to Leo Griffiths. He tried another tack.
Did they have a good relationship?
Billy looked out of the window, as though deciding whether or not to impart whatever was in his head. Ginger was steering Sarah towards a defender with a POA sign dangling from the rearview mirror. Murray hoped she was okay. Hoped Ginger wouldn't say anything to set her off. Billy turned back to Murray.
He didn't treat her right. He was my brother and I loved him, but he wasn't good enough for her.
Murray waited. There was obviously a story behind this.
He liked to drink. Well, we all do, but...
Billy shook his head.
This isn't right. Speaking ill of the dead, it isn't right.
Are you suggesting Tom had a problem with alcohol, Mr. Johnson? There was a long pause before Billy spoke. He looked out of the window. Caroline tried to cover for him, but I'm not stupid. Even if Tom thought I was. This last was said bitterly, muttered more to himself than to Murray. Behind him, Murray saw Ginger open the driver's door of the Defender. Sarah settled herself behind the wheel and adjusted the seat. Ginger would have her out on a test drive if Murray didn't leave soon. He stood up.
You've been very helpful, Mr. Johnson. Thank you.
Murray felt bad leaving the man slumped at his desk, visibly distressed by the memories Murray had forced him to confront. But his priority was Sarah. She was walking towards him as he got to the forecourt. Ginger was standing by the defender, hands thrust miserably in his pockets.
Are you okay? Murray said, when Sarah reached him.
She seemed perfectly content, and he breathed a sigh of relief that Ginger hadn't upset her.
Right as rain.
She had a wicked grin on her face, and Murray glanced again at Ginger, who looked as though someone had just told him Christmas had been cancelled.
What happened to him?
I told him I was interested in the latest model.
Right.
That I wanted something very high spec with lots of extras, and that I was looking to take something away today.
Okay.
Sarah grinned again. And then I said, maybe I'd stick to my bike.
Chapter 29 Anna. My mother rings the bell instantly, then again without dropping her hand, and again, and again, and again. Rita runs into the hall, skids on the tiles, then jumps at the door. She looks back at me, then up at the silhouette of my mother, framed inside the stained glass panel. She whines, confused. My chest feels tight, my face numb. I can't do this. My hands shake uncontrollably, and as the doorbell rings again, panic builds inside me.
Anna!
I turn around, make my feet move.
I walk slowly towards the foot of the stairs. We have to talk about this. I need you to understand. Anna!
Her voice is quiet, but she is pleading. Desperate. I stand. One hand on the banister, one foot on the step. My parents are alive. Isn't this everything I've wanted for the last year? Grandparents for Ella, in-laws for Mark, my mum and dad. Family.
Anna, I won't leave until you understand. I had no choice.
And all at once, I'm decided. I take the stairs two at a time, running from the hall, from the begging, from the excuses my mother is trying to give for the inexcusable. No choice. I had no choice. No choice but to grieve for my parents. No choice but to see the police pour over our lives, to sit in a coroner's court while their deaths were dissected, to organize a memorial service and phone their friends, to hear the same platitudes over and over. I had no choice but to go through pregnancy, labor, the early weeks of anxious motherhood, without my mother's guidance. I had no choice. They did. My parents chose to deceive me. Not only when they disappeared, but on every single day since. The doorbell rings again, again, again. My mother keeps her finger pressed, and the bell rings, shrill and insistent, through the spine of the house. I clamp my hands over my ears and curl into a tight ball on my bed, but still I hear it. I sit up, stand, pace the length of the bedroom. I go into the ensuite and turn on the shower, sitting on the edge of the bath while the room fills with steam and the mirror mists over. Then I strip off my running clothes and step in, pulling the door shut and cranking the temperature till it's so hot it hurts. Beneath the shower, I can't hear the bell. I tip up my head, letting the water fill my ears, my nose, my mouth, until it feels as though I'm drowning. I give in to the tears that started when I saw my mother, and froze the second I understood she'd chosen to stay away. I cry with a physicality I have never before experienced, doubled over with the sobs that forced their way from the pit of my stomach. When I have sobbed so hard I feel too weak to stand, I sit and wrap my arms around my knees, the water running off my bent head and pooling in my lap. I cry until I am exhausted, until the water runs to ice and my flesh is goosebumped. When I switch off the shower, my limbs are stiff and cold. I listen. Silence. She's gone. The sharp stab of grief takes me by surprise. I chastise myself for the chink of weakness it suggests. I have lived without my parents for over a year. I have survived. I will survive. There is nothing they could say now that would win my forgiveness. It is too late. I find comfort in the softness of an old pair of jogging bottoms and a faded sweatshirt I steal from Mark's side of the wardrobe. Thick cashmere socks. I rough dry my hair with a towel and twist it into a loose bun. Just as I am beginning to feel, if not better, then more together, the doorbell rings. I freeze. Wait a full minute. It rings again. The single-mindedness I used to admire, envy, almost, in my mother, now taunts me. She's not going to give up. I could stay here all day and she will wait and ring and shout. White-hot rage cracks through the veneer of calmness I had convinced myself was real, and I storm from my bedroom and down the stairs. How dare she? A whole year. It rattles around my head like a ball bearing in a pinball machine, firing shots indiscriminately. For a whole year she has lied to me. To everyone. I arrive in the hall so fast, and with so little control, that my socks slip from under me, and I crash onto my back. The breath knocked from me with such velocity that when I pick myself up, I feel as sore as if I'd fallen from the top of the stairs. The doorbell rings again. Rita's nowhere to be seen. Even the dog has stopped hoping I'll answer the door.
But when my mother sets her mind to something, she doesn't rest. A whole year. If someone had told me 6 months ago, this morning even, that I would one day tell my mother to leave me alone, I'd have thought them insane. But that is exactly what I'm going to do. The past can't be undone. You can't lie to someone and then bowl back into their lives and expect to be forgiven. Some lies are too big for that. A whole year of lies. I fling open the door.
There you are. I thought you must be upstairs.
You'll have to bring the pram up for me, dear. I don't like doing it with the baby inside in case it topples. Joan looks at me curiously.
Are you all right, dear? You look like you've seen a ghost.
Chapter 30 Murray. Sarah was mopping the kitchen floor. This was not a reflection on Murray's own efforts the previous day, but an indication of Sarah's rising anxiety. The change had been sudden, like the sun disappearing behind a cloud. Murray had tried to hang on to the feeling of contentment he'd had as they'd driven home from Johnson's cars, laughing about Ginger's thwarted sail. But, like trying to recall 30-degree heat in the depths of winter, it had eluded him. Murray wasn't sure what the trigger had been. Sometimes there wasn't one. Sit down and have a cup of tea. I want to do the windows first. It's Christmas Eve. So? Murray looked through the Radio Times for something to distract them both. It's a Wonderful Life was probably not ideal. The snowman's on in a minute. There's a surprise. She dumped the mop in the bucket. I bet even Allard Jones is sick of that one. Murray would have riffed on it, but Sarah's brow was knitted into a deep V as she looked under the sink for window cleaner and a cloth, so he let it go without comment. Murray was good at reading the signs, at taking his lead from someone else, and mirroring their reaction back to them. He'd done it for years with criminals, long before nonverbal communication became something you had to be taught in a classroom. He'd done it for years at home. It was tiring, though, and not for the first time, Murray wished he and Sarah had children to dilute the ripples of her condition. He had wanted them, desperately, but Sarah had been too frightened. What if they take after me? He had deliberately misunderstood. Then they'll be the luckiest kids in the world. What if they inherit my head? My fucked up, bastard, shitty head? She had started crying, and Murray had wrapped her up in his arms so she couldn't see that his own eyes were leaking too. Or my nose, he said gently. There was a hiccup of laughter from the folds of his jumper, and then she'd pulled away. What if I hurt them? You wouldn't. You've only ever hurt yourself. Murray's reassurances had fallen on deaf ears. Sarah became terrified of falling pregnant, refusing to be intimate with Murray. She spiraled into a paranoid episode involving weeks of pointless pregnancy tests, in the unlikely event that Eastbourne had been selected as the location for the next immaculate conception. Eventually, their GP had agreed to refer Sarah for sterilization, for the sake of her mental health. Which meant it was just Murray and Sarah. They could have spent Christmas with Sarah's brother and his family, but Sarah's recent admission meant that no plans had been made. Murray wished he hadn't already got the tree down from the loft, or that he'd had the foresight not to buy a pre-decorated one. At least that would have given them something to do. Something other than cleaning. Sarah was kneeling on the draining board to do the kitchen window, and Murray was looking for another cloth. He may as well make himself useful, when he heard the sound of singing from outside the front door. We three kings of Orient are, one in a taxi, one in a car, one on a scooter blowing his hooter. The singing stopped and was replaced by raucous laughter. What on earth? Sarah was curious enough to put down the window lean and come with Murray to the front door.
Happy Christmas!
Nish's partner Gil thrust a bottle of wine at Murray.
And welcome home!
Nish handed Sarah a gift bag with a large beribboned tag.
You don't get anything, she said to Murray, because you're a miserable old codger.
She grinned.
Aren't you going to invite us in? Proper carol singers get mince pies and mulled wine.
Mince pies, I think we can do, Murray said, opening the door wide. Sarah was clutching the gift bag with both hands, her eyes startled.
I was just...
She looked towards the kitchen, as though planning her escape. Murray felt his heart sink. He held her gaze and wondered how to make her understand that he needed this. Friends over on Christmas Eve, mince pies, carols, normality. Sarah hesitated, then gave a tentative smile.
I was just getting everything ready for Christmas. Come on in.
Murray found the Waitrose mince pies he'd been keeping for the next day, and glasses for the wine Nish and Gil had brought. He found a CD of King's College carols, and then Nish found one of top 10 Christmas hits. Sarah opened her present and hugged everyone for the impromptu party, and Murray thought Nish and Gil could never know what a perfect gift they'd given him.
A little bird tells me you were in the lion's den this morning, Nish said.
That hadn't taken long.
The lion?
Gil was topping up everyone's glasses. Sarah held hers out, and Murray tried not to let his face reflect his thoughts. A bit of alcohol made Sarah buoyant. Happy. A lot had the opposite effect.
Superintendent Leo Griffiths, Nish explained, fond of roaring.
Would the little bird who told you that have had flashing bauble earrings and tinsel in her hair?
No idea. She texted me. I take it your plan to single-handedly solve Eastbourne's historic murders has been thwarted.
Murray took a sip of his wine.
If anything, I'm even more determined to get to the bottom of what happened to the Johnsons, especially now things have escalated.
Nish nodded. The brick's gone for further analysis. No fingerprints, I'm afraid. It's a bugger of a surface, and whoever wrapped the paper around it was forensically aware enough to wear gloves. But I can tell you that the note wrapped around the brick was printed on different paper to the one used for the card, and it was produced on a different printer.
Sarah put down her glass.
They came from different people.
Not necessarily, but it's possible.
That makes sense.
Sarah looked at Murray.
Doesn't it? One person prompting Anna to dig into the past, the other warning her off.
Maybe.
Like Nish, Murray was reluctant to commit, but he was fast coming to the same conclusion himself. They weren't dealing with one person, but two. The anniversary card came from someone who knew the truth about what had happened to Caroline Johnson, and wanted Anna to ask questions. Last night's note was a different matter. An instruction. A threat. No police. Stop before you get hurt.
Why send a warning unless you're the murderer?
Murray couldn't fault Sarah's logic. Whoever threw that brick through the window of Anna's house was responsible for Tom's and Caroline's deaths, and it looked as though they weren't finished with the Johnsons yet. Murray needed to unravel this case before Anna, or her baby, got hurt.
Chapter 31 Anna. Mark and Joan talk, but it's as though I'm underwater. Every now and then, one of them shoots me a concerned look, before offering me tea, or wine, or, why don't you have a little sleep? I don't need to sleep. I need to understand what the hell is going on. Where have my parents been for the last year? How did they fake their suicides so convincingly that no one suspected a thing? And, most importantly, why did they do it? It doesn't make sense. I've found no evidence of debts, no suggestion that my parents moved large amounts of money out of their accounts before they disappeared. When the wills were read, everything, more or less, came to me. Dad borrowed money for the business, but it was only after he died, and Billy fell apart, that the business started struggling. My parents weren't bankrupt. They can't have done this for financial reasons.
My head is spinning. We need to talk, I say, when Joan's out of the room. We do. Mark's face is serious. After Christmas, once Mum's gone home. Let's get a babysitter and go out for dinner. Have a proper talk about everything. I was thinking, the counselor doesn't have to be someone I know, if that's what's bothering you. I can get a recommendation. No, but... Joan comes back in. She's holding a game of Scrabble. I wasn't sure if you had a set, so I brought mine. Shall we have a game now? She looks at me, with her head cocked to one side. How are you doing, love? I know it's hard for you. I'm okay. Lying by omission, passing off my peculiar mood as a symptom of grief. Another Christmas without my parents. Poor Anna. She misses them so much. I shuffle Scrabble letters around on the little tray in front of me, unable to see the patterns in even the simplest of words. What am I going to do? Should I call the police? I think of lovely, kind Murray Mackenzie and feel a fresh wave of shame. He believed me. The only person who admitted there was something not quite right. The only person who agreed my parents might have been murdered. And all the time it was a lie. Jukebox, Joan says. 77. Two words, surely. Definitely one. I tune out from their good-natured argument. At various times over the last 19 months, grief has been overtaken by another emotion. Anger. It's completely normal to feel angry when a loved one dies, Mark said, during my first counseling session, particularly when we feel the person who died made an active choice to leave us. An active choice. My hand, holding a letter E I picked from the pile in the middle of the table, starts to shake violently. I drop the letter onto the rack and push my hands into my lap, squeezing them between my knees. I have spent the last year actively working through, to use Mark's vocabulary, my anger over my parents' suicides. Turns out it was entirely justified. Every second I hold on to this secret is making me more nauseous, more anxious. I wish Joan wasn't here. It's only the third time I've ever met her. How can I throw this at her? And on Christmas Eve. Mark puts down a single tile. X. 9, Joan says. I think you'll find that's a double word score. Oops, my mistake. 18. Watch her, honey. She's a terrible cheat. Don't listen to him, Anna. Hey, guess what, guys? My parents aren't dead after all. They were just pretending. It doesn't feel real. The thought takes hold. What if it isn't? For the last 2 days, I've imagined my mother's presence so strongly, I even smelled her perfume, saw her in the park. What if I've conjured her up? What if the conversation I had on the doorstep was one of the post-bereavement hallucinations Mark was so insistent I was experiencing? I'm going mad. Mark was right. I need to see someone. But it seemed so real. I don't know what to believe anymore. Just after 11, we get ready for midnight mass. The hall is a muddle of coats and umbrellas and Ella's buggy, and I think about all the people I'll see at the church, all the people who will wish me well and tell me they're thinking of me, and say how hard it must be without Tom and Caroline. And I can't. I just can't. We're standing in the doorway, half in, half out. Laura pulls up in the street. No room on the drive with Joan's car squeezed alongside mine and Mark's, and jumps out, wrapping a scarf around her neck. She walks towards us. Happy Christmas Eve! There are introductions. Mum, this is Laura. Laura, this is Joan. And all the time, my heart is thumping fit to burst, and I stare at the floor in case what's in my head is written across my face. How are you doing, lovely? Laura squeezes my shoulder. Solidarity, not sympathy. She thinks she knows what I'm going through, how I feel. Guilt gnaws